Let me talk about the book, Lift Every Voice, the NAACP and the Making of the Civil Rights Movement, just published hot off the presses by Patricia Sullivan. I'd like to first talk about, there are a lot of challenges in writing this kind of a book, and I'll just note a few of them before I begin. First, the NAACP is an organization whose history, or at least we imagine, its history has been much chronicled through biographies of famous civil rights figures, through political scientists who mobilized research mobilization theory, to people who've written about the lawyers, right? Isn't this a much chronicled story? Second, this is the kind of history that no longer excites the scholarly community. For the last generation, the energy in the field of history has gone into social history, the history of people who are far from formal institutions like the NAACP. And third, the NAACP isn't an organization that the American public has been that excited about for quite a while. Of course, a generation, or actually more ago, it was bypassed by other organizations and figures, first Martin Luther King, but then other organizations like SNCC, Black Power, as the focus of fascination, public interest, excitement. Okay, so it's a hard moment at which to write this book. But what I'd like to talk about today is that I think this is a book that takes up and meets all of these challenges, and I'd like to explain why by first trying to situate the book within the literature that's been written, and second, if I have some time, to briefly place the organization in some contemporary context. I'd say perhaps the most daring thing about the book is that it really takes on the aspect of the NAACP that's provoked most of the criticism, historiographical and otherwise, of the organization, and makes it the central piece of the story. The central piece of the story in the book, as you've heard from both Professor Sullivan earlier today, and as you will find if you read the book, and I recommend that you do, it's a gripping read, the central piece of the story are the lawyers. The lawyers are central to the narrative, as are the various pieces of litigation to reach their fruition in Brown versus Board of Education. As a matter of fact, perhaps the central part of the book, the place where it has its most salient tension, occurs just about halfway through the narrative that it chronicles, in the middle of the 1930s, when the NAACP had come in for a wave of criticism that might sound familiar to most of us today. As a matter of fact, we heard some of it in the quote from Ella Baker that Diane Penner-Hughes used earlier. This is criticism that's been launched at the NAACP for a long time and in various forms. But in the middle of the 1930s, people said a bunch of things. First, they said it was top-heavy. The middle-class bureaucrats in New York drove an agenda that was far from the needs and concerns of local communities. Second, the organization faced severe financial constraints. The Great Depression dried up certain aspects of its fundraising, like the Garland Fund money that they expected to finance their litigation, which they never actually got much of. Third, there was an unresolved controversy about whether the central driving force of the organization was what we might call African-American race consciousness, represented by Du Bois, not only in the mid-1930s, the famous controversy over segregation, but as the book makes clear, this is a controversy that's been going on ever since the organization's been founded, and it's a fight between Du Bois and initially people like Oswald Garrison Villard and later Spingarn over whether or not the central driving of the force of the organization is African-American race consciousness, which Du Bois likes, or actually what we might call white paternalism. And also fourth, in the middle of the 1930s, people said that the NAACP had the wrong program. We heard something about that earlier today from Professor Wilson, where lots of people said that no, the fundamental thing was systematic economic inequality. And what the organization was becoming known for were its court cases. Okay, these were the four things that, the four problems, the four criticisms of the NAACP that were out there in the middle of the 1930s. And these are the things that Sullivan takes on and makes the centerpiece of her book. And I think the most important development that responded to the criticism, in Sullivan's view, is the ascension of a particular lawyer to a position of leadership in the organization, and that lawyer's name was Charles Hamilton Houston. Many of you in this room know a lot about Houston, but for those of you who don't, he was a Harvard Law School graduate. He was the first African American to be an editor of the Harvard Law Review. He was the vice dean and the de facto dean of Howard Law School, where he trained people like Thurgood Marshall and Oliver Hill. And he was probably the exemplar of the civil rights lawyer. Now, the frame that Sullivan gives for Houston focuses on what she would call his improvisational approach, right? When people think of lawyers, they think of litigation, they think of courts, they think of formal things. But the Houston that comes out in this book is an improvisationalist. There are wonderful quotes in the book where he says he's an evangelist. He's a stump speaker. The second aspect of Houston that's very important to Sullivan's narrative is that for Houston, a lawyer is not somebody who's in court or in New York. A lawyer is somebody who goes out into the community. And you got a good sense of this in Sullivan's presentation earlier today, which he talked about the many thousands of miles that Houston logs in the 1930s. And Thurgood Marshall, who logs even more miles in the 1940s, I think she said over 40,000 miles a year. These people are always on the road. And in fact, they're always connected to communities. And in fact, the most important lawyers in the NAACP spend very little of their time in the NAACP's national office researching and writing briefs. Houston, also in partnership with Walter White in the book, provides the intellectual energy that makes the organization formidable. In fact, this intellectual energy allows Sullivan to blank a lot of the binary choices that people think that the NAACP had to make, right, between litigation and direct action. Okay, do you litigate or do you try to put people in the streets? Between law versus economic equality, do you bring court cases or do you try to organize the workers? Between central bureaucracy and what we might call populist democracy, is the energy of the organization in New York, or is it out in the branches? And the NAACP that emerges from this book is an organization which I think Professor Pender-Hughes tried to capture this, that's got a lot of different things going on at the same time, mm-hmm. and really isn't caught up in these binary choices, at least if we take it in a very thick context as the book does. And in the succeeding chapters, we see the results of this partnership between White and Houston, not just Brown versus Board of Education, but mobilization of black people in the South. If there is a theme to this book, it's really how much work it takes to mobilize people in the South. Mm-hmm. It isn't just litigating cases. It isn't just asking white funders to give them money, but it's going out and trying to figure out, okay, we want to get registered to vote in, I don't know, Tennessee. Somebody goes down and they register. Then they come back. And then somebody else goes down. And then there's an NAACP chapter in the next town over. Or maybe Walter White or Charles Houston comes through town and they talk to them. But you can see how much work it takes just to get people out to vote. And you can also see some of the fairly horrific repression that is meted out to people for just engaging in these ordinary activities. And we can see how much work it took to create and maintain these very fundamental aspects of American democracy and how much organizational energy the NAACP put into them. So that's more or less the central frame of the book. And in some measure, it's a response to what a lot of the people have written about the NAACP in the last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, depends on how you look at it. But there's a revisionist literature, there's a law revisionist literature, most prominently represented by my colleague on the Harvard faculty, Michael Klarman. But actually, the argument originated with a guy named Joe Rosenberg, who's a political scientist, more or less argues that the NAACP did nothing, that the legal victories in the South didn't desegregate. They put very few black kids in school with whites. And of course, for these kinds of revisionists, the alternative is always something like direct action. Or as Klarman has argued in various iterations, that there's a kind of interracial moderate movement going on in the South that gets derailed by Brown. And in this book, you see that litigation wasn't so much just about getting a case up to the U.S. Supreme Court and getting it implemented. It was about getting people organized. Like, how do we make up a court case? How do we maintain it? How do we maintain the chapters that are going to support it? That's the story that emerges in this particular book. And that was one of the primary functions that lawyers played. You know, this is what Thurgood Marshall did, traveling 40,000 miles a year. Second, there are a bunch of economic revisionists. The most famous article was one that came out about 20 years ago now by Robert Korstadt and Nelson Lichtenstein called Opportunities. Found and Lost. Found and Lost. Then that there's something that Korstadt has called civil rights unionism in his later scholarship, where unions were really the center of it all. And that sort of goes away. And when the civil rights movement really emerges in the form of the NAACP and Martin Luther King, it's got its economic base chopped off. Judith Stein's book is a kind of updated version of this, sort of talking about the NAACP in the 60s. And as we sort of talked about a little bit this morning, you know, a lot of the really careful scholarship, some of which we heard discussed here, is tries to see things in a little bit more complex way. And of course Charles Houston, as he emerges in this book and some other recent scholarship, is somebody who thought that the NAACP didn't have to make that choice, that it was, as Sullivan makes it, improvisational. It was trying to exist within whatever political universe existed at the moment, and trying to use the tools within that universe to get people organized. There's a third wave of revisionist literature, I think, that this book actually responds to implicitly, and it's social history. Social history is the history of the people without politics. The history of the people from the ground up. Trying to give agency to African Americans on the ground in the South. A history in which a bureaucratic middle-class organization like the NAACP seems irrelevant. But again, I think, as I've explained already, really I think the central thesis of this book is a response to social history. How do you get people organized on the ground? Well, you get them organized on the ground by connecting them to others. I think we heard a little bit of this in Professor Pinder Hughes' presentation. By connecting them to a larger organization, by letting them know that if they go down and register to vote and something happens, somebody's going to show up and do something. I think what Professor Sullivan tries to show in this book is that you simply can't have agency on the ground without a bureaucratic structure to back it up, without resources to back it up, and for so much of its history, the NAACP provided those resources. Okay. That's really sort of how I read the book. And I think, really, I'd only sort of do two things before I turn it over. The question I'd ask, I think, of the book, or at least of the NAACP as it emerges in the book, is that, well, it might be true that at least some of the criticisms are right, or at least at some point the NAACP, well, actually did become a bureaucratic middle-class organization that wasn't so connected to what we might call populist democracy on the ground in African American communities. And in some measure, the struggle that we've seen over the last decade or a decade and a half to really set the organization on its right feet is a response to that aspect of the NAACP's history. And I guess if I wanted to press Professor Sullivan a little bit, I'd say, well, kind of, where did it all go wrong? The NAACP that emerges from this book seems like an organization that's incredibly robust as of 1958, when the book, or 1960, when the book leaves off the narrative, that's got a lot of that sort of democratic energy still in it. And did something go wrong later? Or perhaps there's something in the earlier history that leads the organization to come to the impasse that it subsequently did. And then finally, I'd say that, I can't resist sort of mentioning that we're having a symposium on the NAACP in an institution that venerates Thomas Jefferson, a slaveholding president of the United States. And one other aspect of this book that's really worthy of note is how closely the NAACP is connected to the presidency. Because one of the really interesting things just about chapter one is how much Woodrow Wilson helped create the NAACP. Because, of course, in its early years, they didn't know where the money was going to come from. They didn't know whether these black people and white people could work together. That's one of the central challenges of the organization. They didn't know exactly what the program was going to be. They didn't know whether they could actually organize chapters around the country and maintain them. We tend to take all these aspects of the NAACP for granted, but really in chapter one you see how contingent these things were and how much of a possibility that in 1912 or 1914 or 1918 the thing would have just fallen apart. And so much of what kept it together was Woodrow Wilson. Because if Woodrow Wilson became president of the United States just a couple of years after the NAACP's founding and instituted widespread segregation in the federal government. And so much of the organization's early energy, the way you mobilize people, the way you get them to form chapters and come out to meetings, is to have something to protest against. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like what we heard this morning, that the NAACP is a protest organization. So they had something to protest against, that was Woodrow Wilson. Or at other times they had other things to protest against, segregation statutes, residential segregation laws, to file a lawsuit to get a new school or to get a school desegregated, right? But I think from the beginning, it was segregation within the federal government. It was the election of the first Southern U.S. president, a segregationist U.S. president in quite a long time that helped the organization hold together. So I guess if I wanted to bookend this whole thing, I'd say that reading her book makes me think, well, what difference does it make that we now have an African-American president in the United States? Surely something that is a culmination of the NAACP's agenda. But surely it does make a difference for the possibility of protests when the person who's in the office of the presidency, who carries that symbolic power, is one of us rather than one of them. And it's both good and bad, because when it was one of them, i.e. Woodrow Wilson, it was a way to get mobilized. And now that it's one of us, perhaps mobilization becomes much more complex. Thanks.
Excellent, Ken. Thank you.